Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, and live from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, it is Scary Cast. We've got great guests tonight, and I'm Dr. John Stamey, manning the helm. We're waiting on a couple of our hosts. They're busy doing entertainment projects, and they will be joining us as they can. But right now, you've got me in Myrtle Beach. It's raining, but we love it, and it's a beautiful place. Tonight, as we do the first Monday of every month, we have our buddy John LeMay, the author. John has brought his co-author for a series of books, and I've got them sitting right here, and they are magnificent. They put Project Blue Book to shame. This is real research and really exciting stuff. So that's why it's called Cowboys, Aliens, and 20th Century UFOs. First, I'd like to introduce from South Texas, the one and only Noe Torres. Noe, thank you so much for being with us. We're really glad to have you here tonight on ScaryCast.
Well, thank you, Dr. John. I appreciate it very much. It's my first time to be on your show, and I've been intending to be on several times, but there's been various conflicts, those strange conflicts that come in from outer space and boggle all our minds. But tonight, I think we're going to have a fantastic time talking about these ancient UFOs, the Old West UFOs, and a lot of very exciting stuff coming out of the pages of the many books that John LeMay and I have co-written over the past few years. So we're very excited. Thank you.
All right. Just so glad to have you, and I've got a couple questions for you. And then, of course, the one and only John LeMay. How's it going, buddy? It's so good to have you on here.
Hey, John. Yeah, it's always great to be on here. It's like we always say, it's that time of the month.
That is exactly right, and I'm holding these books in my hands. I'm thrilled to have them, the books I'm holding, so that everybody knows, and you can buy them at Amazon. I am holding Old West UFOs, 1865 to 1895. And then I am holding The Coming of the Airships, 1896 to 1899. Boy, you had a lot of stuff happening back then in those 4 years. And then the brand new book, Early 20th Century UFOs, American Sightings, 1900 to 1919. And we want to give a shout out to all of our listeners on WLSC, AM and FM, Myrtle Beach, Loris. We're so glad to have you. Thanks to Banana Jack Murphy for putting us on. If you're listening to us on WLSC, AM and FM, you're listening to us at midnight on Saturday night, my favorite time of the week for spooky stuff and great science and real fiction. Now, I'm going to start the questioning off with Noe Torres. About 4 years ago, I had a fellow named Daniel Allen Jones on, and apparently we both know him. He's a friend of yours, we confirmed. I met him through Lyle Blackburn, our good friend who wrote the Lizard Man book and has been so helpful in getting the Lizard Man Festival up and running. And I want to tell you, Noe, that the Aurora, Texas UFO experience is absolutely it looms larger than Roswell. And that's saying a lot, but I think it's an absolute slam dunk home run of reality and UFOs. Do you mind starting out and telling us about the Aurora crash and everything that happened? Because I just love the story. Is that okay?
Well, I definitely do want to do that, and the Aurora UFO crash story of 1897 is actually what inspired me to start gathering data on UFO sightings from the Old West time period. So a few years back, I ran into John LeMay, who's you've introduced on our program tonight and has been on your show before, but I ran into him in Roswell because I was appearing annually several years in a row as a speaker at the Roswell UFO Festival held in July every year in Roswell, New Mexico, which is John's home, by the way. So I ran into John, and we were just we were kind of shooting the breeze, and you know, Spielberg was about to release his big fictional blockbuster on Cowboys and Aliens, and John said something to the effect, and he can correct me if I'm wrong, but he was talking about how wouldn't it be interesting if we were to do a book about real UFO incidents that happened in the Old West, including the Aurora incident in Texas. And I said, John, you are a man after my own heart, because I have started putting together a file with these old UFO cases. And the reason they interested me is because they all occurred before airplanes were developed. As you know, it wasn't until the early part of the 20th century that we had Orville and Wilbur Wright and the very first airplane flight. So whatever these pioneers and cowboys of the Old West were seeing flying around in the sky, made of metal and traveling incredibly fast distances, they were certainly not birds, which is the only other thing that was up there. So thus began the series of books, which we have now done quite a number of books together, and we focused, because of John's background as a historian and my background in UFO research, we've now done a series of books focusing on UFOs prior to what is commonly referred to as a modern UFO era, which would be 1945 and onward. But prior to 1945, until recently, there has been almost absolute silence as to what sort of UFO cases occurred. So that was just to give you a background before we launch into the whole Aurora thing. It was actually Aurora that inspired the series of books that John LeMay and I have now gone on to write.
You know, I'm really glad that that is my favorite story. It just kind of, everything just fits in, doesn't it, Millie?
It sure does. And I was planning a book on UFO cases from the 1800s when John suggested that we do something together, which I'm extremely thankful that we ended up doing that, because our very first book, which was released, by the way, I think on the same day that Spielberg's movie came out, if memory serves, we tried to time it so that it would be released at the same time as the movie, and we called it The Real Cowboys and Aliens. And so we released it, and a marquee chapter in that book was a chapter having to do with the Aurora incident. And for those of you that aren't familiar with the story, I can go ahead and just summarize it, and then we can go into more detail if you'd like, Dr. John, up to you. But April 17th, 1897, there's a small town located west of Fort Worth, Texas. You can go there today, and you can see all the pertinent sites where this story took place. In fact, my good friend Daniel Jones and I have been there on several occasions. Daniel is involved with the Dallas area MUFON, Mutual UFO Network. He and I get together often. He started appearing a few years ago, Daniel did, at the UFO conferences that I was organizing. I've organized a number of UFO festivals and conferences throughout the state of Texas. We did one in Del Rio, Texas. We did one in Presidio, Texas, another in Laredo. We've done one here in Edinburgh that is now entering its 10th annual. So we have these festivals we've done all over the state of Texas. We also organized one in Roswell, New Mexico. We did the Roswell, New Mexico UFO conference a few years back in 2012, as a matter of fact. So I ran into Daniel at these conferences we were having in Texas. He would come down from Dallas and attend. And at first I knew him as a heck of a good drummer because, you know, as I'm sure you're aware, he plays the drums. and he teaches.
Absolutely, he's awesome.
He teaches drums to students who want to learn how to play them. And he was a drummer at the UFO festival we held in Del Rio, Texas, a few years back. And so I was walking, near the outside the conference hall, and he was out there with his drum set, and he was putting on quite a good show. So I got to talk to him and got to know him. And it turns out he's quite the enthusiast for UFOs and paranormal, Bigfoot, and numerous other topics. So we have become close over the years, and we've done a lot of research together. Last time he was down here about a year and a half ago, pre-pandemic, right before the pandemic hit, we were doing some research into an old decommissioned Air Force base here in South Texas that supposedly now is an agricultural research center. But strange things go on there, very strange things. That's a topic for another day. But on April 17th, 1897, something very strange happened in this sleepy town called Aurora, Texas. And as I mentioned when I started, Aurora is a tiny little town. If you drive a little too fast, well, number one, you'll get pulled over by the local state patrol. But the second thing is, if you drive too fast, you'll totally miss this little town. It's located west of Fort Worth, so heading to the west out of Dallas, and then you pass Fort Worth, and then you'll come to Aurora. But back in 1897, there wasn't much there. It was just a very quiet, sleepy town. And at 6 o'clock in the morning, the people who were up early, as people tended to get up early in those days at around daybreak, they noticed this strange object in the sky. They described it as a cigar-shaped UFO, metallic silver in color. It appeared suddenly in the skies above Aurora, and at first seemed to be going quite fast and then started slowing down. It was generally moving from south to north. And, there were hot air balloons, and there was the beginnings of dirigibles at that time, but there was nothing like this. It was described in newspaper accounts in the Dallas newspaper and in the Fort Worth newspapers later. It was described as being made of a, quote, an unknown metal resembling somewhat a mix of aluminum and silver. So one of the witnesses was looking up at that ship traveling across the sky of Aurora that morning. He guessed that the ship must have weighed several tons. So definitely not a lighter-than-air scenario, some kind of huge machine, some kind of cylindrical metallic silver object. And as the craft kind of eased down toward town, some of the witnesses said that it seemed that the object might be having some type of mechanical problem because it was slowing down and descending. And finally had reduced speed to about 10 to 12 miles per hour, when suddenly something totally unexpected happened. There was like one single windmill in that vicinity, in that part of town of Aurora, and the object crashed into the windmill, which belonged to the local judge, by the way. So the newspaper accounts said that the windmill at Judge Proctor's property was destroyed by this airship, and it went to pieces with a terrific explosion, scattering debris over several acres of ground. It destroyed not just the windmill, but the adjacent water tank and the judge's flower garden as well. So it was quite a disastrous event for this little town there. But before I go on with the story, I just wanted to give space for you all to add comments, or maybe John wants to pipe in as well about the initial sighting and crash of the object before we describe the the strange being that was found in the wreckage.
Yeah,
no,
John,
I think
Romaine,
you covered
what
it
do
all,
you have to share with us?
Oh, I can't add anything to that, except for it's unfortunate because, you know, when we talk about the occupant, they don't describe it very well. That they basically, I think, just call it a Martian. Didn't they call it a Martian, Noe, or did they say it was not of this earth?
Well, the exact words that appeared in the Dallas Morning News on April 19th, a couple days later, said the following. The pilot of the ship is supposed to have been the only one on board, and while his remains are badly disfigured, enough of the original has been picked up to show that he was not an inhabitant of this world. Mr. T.J. Weems, the United States Signal Service officer at this place and an authority on astronomy, gives it as his opinion that he was a native of the planet Mars. So John is
right. That's
right.
Yeah, back
the,
then,
that was the opinion. That was the opinion of the Signal Service officer, which was a military officer that was assigned to this area. But there was a lot of speculation at that time, 1897, about Mars having life, and the canals on Mars had been discovered by looking through early telescopes, and so it was just a natural assumption for people to make, to suppose that perhaps it came from the planet Mars. But the story got really weird after the crash of the object. The pilot's body was found strewn along with all the metallic debris all over the property of Judge Proctor. And as we listened to the account in the newspaper that the strange body of a little man, as it was referred to, a little man that was clearly not an inhabitant of the Earth, could have possibly been from Mars, according to one witness. But now, the interesting thing is that they found debris with strange writing, some kind of unknown hieroglyphics. They checked the pilot's body, and they found that he was carrying papers written in an unknown language. It may have been some kind of record of the journeys that the craft had been on. They were written in some sort of unknown hieroglyphics, as I mentioned, could not be understood by anyone. And many visitors, now this is a real interesting part of the story, is that people came from all around the neighboring towns, all around Aurora, to look at the crash site and to look at the body. The newspaper article says, quote, "The town is full of people today who are viewing the wreck and gathering specimens of the strange metal from the debris." And
I've got a quick question for you.
Yes, sir.
Whatever happened, or do we know what happened to all of the to the papers the gentleman or the space alien, let's call him a space alien. And here's Devin Tate, our man in Hollywood. Devin, we're glad to have you, and Noe Torres is telling us all about the Aurora, Texas incident in 1897. So we're glad to have you here with us, buddy.
That's great. Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Now, anyway, Noe, whatever happened to that type of evidence, do we know what happened to it? And that would be the most astonishing find in history. It really would. It would be right up there with the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Well, you know, we have been the originator, the person that did more to get this story out and to get it in the hands of the public, and what was the late great UFO researcher Jim Mars, who I had the privilege to know and to work with closely on several projects. He collaborated with me on the play that I wrote based on the Aurora UFO crash a few years back. I wrote a play for stage, a stage play, in which I basically recounted.
I'm going to have to interrupt you, Noe. Is there any way that we can I can get a copy of that play? Any way?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I can. It's I sell paper copies of it through Amazon, so I have some available, and I'll send one out to you. That's not a problem. But
wow,
anyway, as
I'm
mentioned,
sorry for interrupting. Okay.
Yeah, I wrote the stage play, which I collaborated with Jim Mars on. And Jim Mars and I spoke at a number of UFO conferences together, and I had him down to speak at several of the conferences that I organized. But the reason I mentioned Jim is, well, he was a great UFO researcher and the predominant researcher on the Aurora UFO crash, who unfortunately died a couple of years ago. But he and I used to speak and speculate about where all the debris and the documents that were found on the crash might have gone. Now, we know, and Jim was instrumental in bringing this forward, we know that some of the debris was taken by all the people that swarmed into town and to look over the this amazing incident that had happened, and they took the debris with them. So scattered throughout this North Texas, probably in people's attics or who knows where, there's probably a lot of these pieces of the crashed UFO from Aurora 1897. But we also know, based on Jim Mars's research, that some of it got thrown down in the water well, an old water well that had been more or less abandoned on the Judge Proctor's property there near where the crash happened. And many years later, one of the local residents who bought the property, or I don't remember if they inherited or bought it, but they actually they were actually drinking water from out of that well, and they developed this horrible disease that basically transformed their body. And it was almost, they almost look sort of like, you know, people have seen the Elephant Man, where the body gets deformed and the bone structure gets deformed and big lumps occur on the body. I don't remember the exact name of the condition. There's a medical name for it. But Jim Mars and other UFO researchers speculated that it could have been because of the debris that got thrown down that well this particular gentleman later, many years later, developed this strange disease from it. There's been attempts to, there's been several attempts to dig up the well, to find some of the debris that might still be there after over 100 years. But they've been met with limited success. Some metallic fragments have been recovered, and some of those fragments contain traces of elements that could not be identified by spectrographic analysis. But there's never been anything conclusive or definitive. There has been some debris. But the most interesting element of this story, I think, to a lot of people is that the townspeople, after finding the body of the little man in the wreckage of the crashed UFO, they decided to give the creature a proper Christian burial in the town cemetery back in 1897, despite the fact that he was obviously not an inhabitant of the earth. So they very carefully took the little man over to the Aurora Cemetery, and where the body still lies today, by the way. And there is a state historical marker erected by the State of Texas Historical Commission commemorating there that it says, to quote directly from it, it says, this cemetery is also well known because of the legend that a spaceship crashed nearby in 1897 and the pilot killed in the crash was buried here. So a lot of people go to see this plaque, this historical marker that's been put up by the state of Texas right at the entrance to the Aurora Town Cemetery. And they have, the townspeople now have a stone marker placed where the suspected location, burial site of where the alien was buried back in 1897. So that's one of the most fascinating parts of the story. There were a number of, when this story broke in the 1970s, because Jim Mars and others were doing the background research on it, it had kind of died out of people's attention for many decades, and then there was a lot of interest in UFOs in the late 60s, early 70s in Texas, and the story kind of surfaced again, and Jim Mars and others brought out the fact that this had happened, and they interviewed a couple of people who were little children when this happened in 1897, and they were still alive in the early 1970s. And one of them gave a very clear account that she remembered distinctly hearing about the story, being told by her parents not to go over to where the object crashed, being told that a body that was not human was recovered from the crash. And so all of this was collaborated years later by one of the witnesses, one of the townspeople, who, although she was very little at the time, she was 6 or 7 at the time, she remembered all the activity in town on that day. So I find it interesting, John, that you say, Dr. John, that you say that this is of more interest to you in a lot of ways than the Roswell case, because it definitely is a fascinating story.
And I'm sorry, John LeMay is from Roswell, and I love his stories because he's told them that there is something very special about the there is something very special to me about the Aurora crash. And now I have done some research on this, and I found some articles, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but I have been told that certain government entities exhumed the body and it's no longer there.
Well, nobody knows for certain where exactly. The story is that nobody knows for certain where the body is anymore because records have been lost. The original markers that were placed where the body was were removed or stolen. And so the story now is that they have an approximate location of where they think the body was buried, based on other burials that were done in that time frame, but they don't know exactly. And the owners of the cemetery, it's privately owned, will not allow any excavation of any of the graves. So what has been done by researchers is they've done studies using ground penetrating radar of the suspected location of the alien burial, and they have found, using the radar, of course, it doesn't give you as much data as excavating would, not nearly, but they have found, traces of something down there. They found remains of something that they can't, they don't have, they obviously can't get all the data that we would like. It is possible that the body is not even there anymore. I mean, that's certainly possible.
Right.
And
I want to share something with you in my research that it is a parallel. I thought long and hard. I began the South Carolina Lizard Man Festival 4 years ago. There were there were 14 police reports of sightings of a lizard man. between 1988 and 1990. And I fought like mad to get the Lee County Observer, which is owned by a company in Camden. I got a letter from them stating that I could reprint the stories of the Lizard Man. There were 14 stories, and I had to go take pictures of these things with my cell phone. There, over in Bishopville, there's no such thing as digital copies of anything. And I felt like the historical value, and they are in my upcoming book, Lizard Man Companion. The historical value of those stories is immense because none of the police reports can be found. Now, I just think it's ridiculous. There's a huge cover up there, but at least I have copies, and they're going to go to print of the newspaper stories. And I think these historical documents, I mean, they tell a tale. They really do. And when the only thing I'll ever correct you on is there's no such thing as a legend about Aurora. That's a real incident. Don't you agree?
Yeah, that's the only thing about the state of Texas's historical marker that we totally disagree with. They use the word legend, and in order to be accurate, I did read that part from the marker, but of course I agree with you 100% on that.
I mean,
I want to bring the story up to date, if I could, John, up to the present. In 2016, I had the extreme honor of being invited by Daniel Jones, our mutual friend, and Jim Mars, to be a speaker at the first annual and the only one that's been held, Aurora Alien Encounter Conference, which we all want to see revived. And it was an amazing event, by the way. About 400 people attended, even though Aurora is not on the beaten path. I just want to check if my audio is okay because I'm hearing some clicking.
It must be the men in black because for me, your audio is perfect.
Okay, so in 2016, we had myself, we had Travis Walton, we had Jim Mars, we had a great lineup of speakers at the community center there in Aurora, Texas. And it was after attending that event and having a chance to talk to Jim Mars that I became inspired to write the play about the Aurora incident, which I started writing shortly around that time period, 2016, 2017, and I released in 2018, which is called Aurora, Spaceship Crash in an Old West Town, and it's available on Amazon if anyone's interested. So what I did with the story was I took the well-known factual historical incident of the Aurora UFO crash and the events previous to it and afterward, and I took that and I put it into a fictional context with a number of characters that I infused into the story and kind of a dramatic narrative about what might have happened. Since we have very limited data, we have, a couple of very brief newspaper articles, and we have speculation over many decades. I wanted to just create a story that may have been what happened. There may be elements of it that were similar to what actually happened. And I tried to incorporate into it what I thought might have been government involvement in trying to cover it up. And also I created I gave a unique perspective on the aliens themselves, and that there may have been more than one, even though only one body was found. So I think the story turned out well, and I've gotten some very positive comments about it. The objective there was to try to have the play produced and put on stage at the next Aurora UFO Festival. Unfortunately, the town of Aurora, which is very limited in its economic abilities, and also, you know, the pandemic came along and all of that, so it never got done, but perhaps in the future.
Wow, that's wonderful, and I look forward to getting a copy of that. And,
sure.
And I can tell you, in a parallel vein, and I'm very glad that Devin Tate is with us, our man from West Hollywood. When we had the Lizard Man Festival last year, Devin produced a documentary on the lizard people of Los Angeles. Right, Devin?
Yes, I love the legend of the lizard people. It's a great story.
It really is, and we were very fortunate, and I will offer this because she is a friend of mine. We have an amazing psychic that normally joins us on Scare. Well, we have a psychic and one of the top surgeons in the country that normally join us. They had family events going on. But, in fact, Devin, if you wouldn't mind reporting to Noe just how accurate Robin McRae can be, the Pabst Blue Ribbon incident, the Blue Ribbon incident. Do you mind sharing that with him?
Yeah, not at all. No, I had been talking to Robin because I had a very good friend and musical collaborator of mine who passed away back in February, and I wanted to see if I could reach out and, you know, communicate with her, and I wanted Robin to help me because I knew Robin would know how to do that. So we did it here on the show on ScaryCast, and kind of towards the end of it, Robin said she had seen or she had gotten a vision of a blue ribbon that, you know, my friend Amy was kind of showing her, and she asked me if it meant anything to me, and at the moment I couldn't think of anything. But then within, you know, that next morning, I opened my closet door, and I had a small stack of shirts and clothes that we had taken from Amy's apartment after she had passed away. And right there in the middle of it was a Pabst Blue Ribbon shirt, which was one of her favorite shirts from back in the day. And it just obviously sent chills down my spine the second I saw it, because I knew obviously that's what Robin was talking about. That's what Amy was trying to tell me, that she knew that I had saved that shirt of hers, you know, to remember her by.
What I was going to say is, because Robin is a known quantity, she's actually known all over the world for being associated with the great Bigfoot researcher, Dr. Igor Bortsev. And, you know, she's one of my dearest friends. And I will speak to Robin, and I will see if you're okay with it. I like to push the envelope here on ScaryCast. But I would like for Robin to take a look back in 1897 and see what she sees. Robin is amazingly, amazingly accurate. In my book, The Lizard Man Companion, she talks about tunnels underneath the moon, because one of the greatest remote viewers of all time was Ingo Swann, and he talked about them. Well, come to find out, she talked about them as well. Come to find out, in 2009, there was an article published by NASA that there were these exact tunnels as described by Robin. So I think Robin is, as said, she's one of my very best friends. And it's a shame she couldn't be on here tonight, but it doesn't mean that we all can't get together and hang out virtually or whatever. But I would love to have her take a look back then, because she can do it.
She's as good as anything. Here's the interesting part about going out to Aurora, Texas, is there's a certain feeling that you get out there. I haven't experienced it at any other UFO sites quite the same way, but there's some residual something going on when you approach, when you walk up to where the crash site happened, which we did. We took a hike up to the little hill, which used to be Judge Proctor's property, and Daniel Jones went up there with me. And we also walked down, not too far away from there, is the town cemetery where the alien is buried. And I really feel that Robin would get some incredible vibes if she ever were able to go down to Aurora, Texas. There's just no place like it. Travis Walton, you know, I'm sure he's interested in all things related to UFOs, and he felt it as well. He knew there was something special that had happened there, and it was in his own mind he was relating it to his own experience being abducted in the 70s. So it was an incredible experience, and certainly there's still something there to this, even all these many years later.
Right. Well, I mean, what we can do is we can obviously discuss this more offline, and we can figure out what we can do, because in my humble opinion, I think Aurora is a singular event in the world, and we are fortunate that we have as much information about it as we do, regardless of the fact that we don't have very much. I think it's a very important historical thing. John LeMay, I'm going to guess that you agree with me about the singularity and the importance of Aurora.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and you were teasing earlier about how I'd feel about it competing with Roswell, but, you know, you got to respect your elders, and Aurora happened 50 years before Roswell.
You know, it did, didn't it? Exactly 50 years before.
Uh-huh.
Wow. Thank you for that factoid. That's very important. The 50, it's like it was 20 years ago today and Sergeant Pepper taught the band to play, but it was 50 years ago today, or at least when Roswell happened and we had Aurora, so it's kind of an amazing thing. So anyway, I want to thank you just to say we really appreciate you telling us all about this. Do you have any more about it before we hit you with some more good questions?
Actually, I have a lot more about Aurora. It's probably the most interesting crash retrieval story, as we've all noted, certainly prior to Roswell. And one of the interesting things about it is when Roswell happened in 1947, there was already kind of a playbook in place among the government and military to kind of keep these things basically hidden from the American public. It was just beginning, but already there was this development in the late 40s, early 50s, where they were going to keep all that information away from the public. Now, in our day today, people don't realize how much of a significant development in recent years that the government has actually now come out and said that they admit that there are strange objects flying around in our skies. They don't know what they are. They don't know where they came from or what they're doing. But they exhibit a technology, they say. This is the government, the military speaking of the United States. They exhibit a technology that is at least 200 to 300 years more advanced than anything we have on this planet. So for government and military leaders to be saying that to us today is a significant departure from all of these years of cover-up we've had, decades of cover-up in the modern UFO era, certainly since the 1940s. And the interesting thing is that in when we look at the Aurora case, of course, it was shortly after the formation of the United States as a country. I mean, we hadn't been in existence that long. It was the tail end of the 19th century, nearly the beginning of the 20th century. And there wasn't this organization in place quite yet where the military was going to try to cover, or the U.S. government was going to try to cover something like this up. They didn't know what to do with it. They weren't really that aware. So that gives us the opportunity to explore more about this very early case, which is one of the reasons that John and I are doing research into these early cases, because there was no cover-up factor to the extent that we saw much later.
That's just amazing. It really is. Again, I'm so glad that we got on this topic. I think it's very important, and I think historically, this episode of ScaryCast is going to be one that people will remember because it's so important. I've never heard such a good audio recount of Aurora, and I just got to say thank you so much, Noe. It's just unbelievable, and we're going to have you and John back. There's so much more. I think we've just touched the tip of the iceberg, don't you?
Absolutely, absolutely. There's a lot of interesting stories that we could delve into in the future, but tonight I just wanted to give kind of an overview and kind of spark people's imagination. And I'd also like to send you a copy of my play, and then perhaps we can come back on and discuss it at some point in the future.
I've got your phone number, and we'll chat just a little bit after the show and see how we can work together doing research. Because, again, your research in UFOs parallels mine in cryptids, and actually mine and Devin's, and I'm gonna include Devin as my partner in this, because the lizard man is real. People saw this thing. We have police reports that have disappeared. I cannot get through Freedom of Information. The lady told me how much it would cost to find out how Christopher Jones died. He was the first witness of the lizard man that came forward, and his father took him to the sheriff's office. And it is astonishing how much they wanted to let me get this information. I just couldn't afford it. I mean, I'm sorry. It was a couple thousand dollars, and I just didn't really have it to work on that. So there are a lot of parallels between the research that Devin and I are doing and the research that you and John are doing. Just the fact that they may be different, you know, different entities, but they are so similar in the cover-ups and all this stuff. So I've got to thank you for all the information that you've given us tonight. And I guess what I'd like to do in the time remaining, if you don't mind, I would like for each one of you and John to tell us your favorite story from the new book, 20th Century UFOs, American Sightings, 1900 to 1919, because that's the one that's on the tip of everyone's tongue. People love this book. So if I may, I would like to ask you first, Noe, and then you, John, tell us your favorite story and why you love that story from this book. Is that okay?
Certainly. It's our pleasure to talk about our books. You know, they become like our kids. We slowly bring them to fruition and nurture them and watch them grow. So John and I, we finished our Real Cowboys and Aliens series, which focused on the 1800s from from the year 1800 until 1899. So the last book in that series was the Coming of the Airships book that we were talking about earlier, covered the period of 1896 to 1899. And that was the third book of the trilogy, which started with Early American UFOs, was the first book in the Real Cowboys and Aliens series. Then we went to Old West UFOs, which we briefly mentioned, 1865 to 1895. And then the third book in the trilogy was the Coming of the Airships. Even though it only covered a three-year period of 1896 to 1899, it contained probably the most material of our three books, because there was so much happening during that three-year span. All of the so-called airship sightings, the Aurora UFO crash, entity sightings all over North America. So then John and I proceeded to start a new series of books delving into UFO cases of the 20th century. And so starting with the year 1900, it was the turn of the century, the turn of the last century. America was becoming more industrialized. Our population was growing. We were starting to see major technological achievements. It was the beginning of electricity. It was the beginning of aviation, would begin within that time span of 1900 to 1919. It was the beginning of industry, American industry, mass production of books and newspapers and other periodicals. There was a lot going on. So John and I were, when we decided to launch into the 20th century, the early 20th century, we wanted to see what was going on in the realm of science, of scientific investigation into UFOs and actual documented cases, which I want to stress that every story that we tell in our books is backed up by historical documents of the time period. This isn't just hearsay stuff that somebody told us had happened way back when. We delved back into the actual documents that were published at the time, into the historical record. My own background, I've been a librarian for over 30 years, and I've done a lot of research for other people as well as for myself. So my background in research and academic research and my skills as a librarian just kind of always caused me to look under every rock and examine every possible angle of a story. So that's what we've done with all of our stories that we tell in these books. So the new book, as we've mentioned, covers 1900 to 1919. And the cover story, the cover of the book depicts the ship Titanic going down by the head in the North Atlantic. The famous sinking of the SS Titanic in the year 1912 in the North Atlantic, April 15th, 1912, which, by the way, we timed the release of our new book for the anniversary of the sinking of the Titanic. So our book was released in April of this year, April 2021. And so the cover story is that when the Titanic began to sink, many passengers got on lifeboats and were able to be lowered into the frigid waters of the North Atlantic, and the lifeboats moved out away from the sinking ship so as not to be caught by its wake. And so you had all these little tiny boats all around the huge spectacle of this the world's most advanced and glamorous passenger vessel going down quickly into the waters of the Atlantic, when suddenly a number of witnesses on those lifeboats said that they saw glowing orbs of light hovering overhead as if they were watching the spectacle of the Titanic sinking. And when we, John and I examined those eyewitness accounts, we were amazed. So here we have an event that's one of the marquee events, tragic marquee events in the history of our world. Over 2,000 passengers on board that ship, more than 1,500 of which died. It was a traumatic, it was a rip in time and in history. So we don't know exactly why there would be such an interest on the part of these beings to observe this event, but the witnesses to the sinking of the Titanic, many of them described that these star-like orbs of light, which appeared very close to the horizon all around the ship, we were just amazed. And in the chapter on the sinking of the Titanic and the UFO sightings related to it, that is definitely my favorite chapter in the book. John and I really enjoyed writing that and doing the research behind it. I just want to close my narrative about that by saying that we conclude the chapter this way. Could the disappearance of the White Star liner Neronic, which was kind of a sister ship to the Titanic, also be related to UFOs? That was also speculated by famous paranormal researcher Charles Fort. So there was something about the White Star liners, and it had encountered also something very paranormal. But obviously something strange happened with the sinking of these boats. So, that definitely is my favorite story from the new book.
That is an incredible story because I read A Night to Remember. I'll never forget when I was in high school. I wrote a huge report on it. It was one of the, and that was in the 70s. And even still in the 70s, it was an incredible story. John LeMay, what is another favorite story of yours from that great book?
Well, I feel bad to call this one my favorite story because it's a tragic story, but it's so interesting. This is what I love about working with Noe is I did the first pass at this chapter, and then Noe did the second pass, and he just really dug into it and discovered all these really interesting things that nobody else had. So I love Jerome Clark's stuff. Clark, he does what Noe and I do, which is comb through these old newspaper articles and find all sorts of paranormal stuff. But Clark did it probably back in the 90s when he actually had to go on microfiche, and it was much more difficult. Noe and I are kind of spoiled because we can do it digitally on our home computer. But Clark had found this story about a woman named Idella Ford who boarded a train. The year was 1911. She boarded a train to go and see her mother, I think, in a neighboring town or neighboring state. And when she got off the train to see her mother, she was very disturbed. And she didn't want to talk about what happened to her, but she implied that she had been taken, and she had strange marks on her body. And she was never the same after this train ride. Before that, she was perfectly sane, normal woman, had children. And after that, though, they had to commit her to an asylum. And eventually someone talked about, or someone heard her talk about beings coming from the sky and taking her, and she was afraid they would come back. And she eventually committed suicide. And I don't think that detail was in Jerome Clark's book, if I remember right. And I don't think I included it in my first pass of the chapter. But when I gave it to Noe dug up all these newspaper articles about Idella Ford and her tragic suicide in 1911. And It was, I think, in the 1970s, Idella Ford's sister wrote a letter to J. Allen Hynek, because by the 1970s, people were talking about alien abductions, and they knew what they were, whereas in 1911, nobody had a concept of alien abduction, and when Idella would talk about beings coming from the sky, they tended to think of it kind of in terms of revelation and apocalyptic visions. They never even thought of her being abducted by aliens. So it's a tragic story, but it's very interesting. And I mean, when a person kills themselves because they're worried beings are going to come from the sky and take them, and when they had no prior history of mental illness, that's kind of an indisputable story, you know? So, I mean, that's probably what I think is one of the most interesting stories in the book.
I mean, that was it's just like a lure. It happened. It happened.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
When I hadn't heard about that, by the way, when John started the chapter and I had a chance to kind of elaborate, it was an amazing revelation to me. That is a fascinating story, and it's so obvious to me that that was an alien abduction that totally ruined this poor woman's life. Of course, back in those days, it was not a phenomenon that was well known. There were no support groups. There was no therapy available. There was no counseling. So she just could not live with it, and she ended up hanging herself in the asylum.
That's horrible. Well, I'll tell you what. I will make sure that both of you gentlemen, John, I don't know if you have a copy of my book, Look Up in the Sky, Aliens, UFOs, and Anomalies.
You sent me one. Thank you. Yep, I've got
okay.
one.
And Noe, I'll make sure that you get a copy of that, and you can make your own judgment of my 8 stories in there. And I think I know what you'll say. So anyway, I'll make sure you get a copy of it tomorrow. Absolutely.
Good.
And I've had there, you know, it's funny, when things happen to you on your timeline, you can't help it. I mean, pardon my grammar, but shit happens. It just does. And I mean, yeah, I can't explain it, you know, whatever, but I am grateful that whatever happened to me happened. I think it was very important. So here's what I'd like to do. I would like for all four of us, Devin, John LeMay, and Noe, and me, if it's okay, let's all close. We got a little bit of time, and let's all close with a reflection about UFOs and their importance in our culture, and whatever you want to say. And Noe Torres, do you think that's a cool thing for us to do?
Well, I reflect on this every day, so definitely yes.
All right, well, sir, I'm gonna pick on you first, because you have been the light in the tunnel for us tonight. You have given us great stories, and it has been just an immense pleasure having you here, and I hope that we can stay in touch, and that we can work together, even though our disciplines are far apart, they're not so far apart. So the spotlight, sir, is on you.
Well, thank you. And before we go into that aspect of it, I wanted to give one more very interesting story, if we have time, that arose from our latest book.
Absolutely.
You know, we've just gone through this horrible pandemic, which we have lost so many people throughout the world, and this COVID-19 pandemic that affected so many people all over. Well, during the time period in which our book is based, there was another similar pandemic, and we have a chapter in the book called Virus from Outer Space, because believe it or not, the scientists the leading scientists of the time period, 1918. It was near the close of the time period that our book is based in. Some of the leading scientists believed that the virus which brought about the so-called Spanish flu, which killed so many people all over the world in 1918, 1919 as well, they believed that this virus might have come to planet Earth from outer space. Now, when John and I found these articles stating this, we were just amazed. And it was so timely because while we were writing the book, we were still going through our current pandemic, which had a lot of parallels, by the way, to the 1918 and 1919 Spanish flu. So according to an article published in the New York Herald in January 1920, some of the leading scientists were entertaining the possibility that the Spanish flu pandemic may have originated in outer space. And that article quoted one of the world's greatest scientists and inventors of the time, Thomas Edison, who is credited as the inventor of electricity. Anyway, they quoted him as saying, quote, "We have no reason positively to declare that definitive influences, even other than electrical, have not reached out to us out of space. There was the Spanish influenza, so-called, for example. We are not sure that it originated on this planet. It spread everywhere, irrespective of the lines of human travel." And in the article, Edison added the following: "It has been established that the flu pandemic appeared upon Pacific Ocean islands, which had had no communication with any infected portion of the world." In other words, no people had traveled there from anywhere else in the world and could not have spread the infection to those areas, and yet people became infected. Ships reaching utterly isolated islands found half of the inhabitants of those islands ill or dead of the disease. So what Edison was saying, he was theorizing that the pandemic might have been deposited upon the Earth from outer space. He said, "Some scientific men have said that we were passing through a cloud of benzene vapor floating in space. It might affect all humanity physically. It might affect all human thought, distorting it." So there were a number of other scientists who thought that perhaps the plague of 1918 and 1920 could have originated from an extraterrestrial origin. So we close the chapter this way. So did the 1918 flu pandemic originate in outer space? We may never know for certain. But even as these words are being written in June 2020, our world is again in the grips of another horrible pandemic whose origins are still somewhat unexplained. Are there forces at work, possibly extraterrestrial, conspiring to keep our planet's burgeoning population under control through these pandemics? So I leave you that with food for thought. But getting back to the reflection that we are all looking at now, the topic of UFOs is a topic that should be foremost in everyone's minds. And it saddens me that a lot of people on this planet give almost no time at all in their thinking process to ponder life on other planets, the possibility, the reality that extraterrestrials have visited the Earth in the past, that they are very likely visiting today. We see all these sightings that are being made by military pilots. You have multiple pilots and multiple aircraft taking video of these strange objects that the military experts themselves admit are between 200 and 300 years more advanced technologically than anything we have on Earth. So where are they coming from? What is their purpose? So the questions that all of us should be pondering are, what does this mean in the greater scheme of things to our lives, to our place in the universe? What do these beings that have been coming to our planet and observing us for centuries, what is their agenda? Do they have an agenda? Or are we just the subject of some kind of incredible long-term scientific study? I remember my late friend Stanton Friedman told me on numerous occasions that perhaps they are studying us like we would study a colony of ants. We would keep our distance from them. We would we have no desire to become an ant and go live in the anthill. We just want to study them from afar. We really don't want to get too involved with them. We do our best not to interfere with them, but they are an interesting study. We can learn a lot about ourselves by studying their behavior and the patterns of their lives. So perhaps that's what's going on. So this is a matter for deep reflection, and really the great thinkers of the world spend a lot of time looking into the matter of life on other planets and the visitations we've had over the years. It's definitely something we should constantly reflect upon every day.
I mean, we've had visitations. That's a fact. Anybody that says we haven't, well, they're wrong. And I like the way you put that, and I wanted to say thank you so much for your reflections and your thoughts, and we want to stay in contact with you and continue the dialogue. And John LeMay, you are next, sir.
What I want to say is I think that everyone on this podcast tonight, or we're not just a podcast, you're a radio show too, but everyone on the show tonight, we can all take pride in the fact that we believed in UFOs and aliens and all that before the government and the media told us it was okay to believe in them. Because right now, like I just said, the government and the media seem to have some sort of weird partnership going on. We don't know how exactly it works, but we know something's going on there where they're leaking this information to the public, you know, and what once was so crazy and kooky to believe in is now mainstream. You know, you won't be looked at, you won't get an eye roll if you tell people you believe in UFOs or aliens anymore because they're on the news finally. So, you know, we can just be proud that we didn't need the government or the media to tell us it was okay to believe in those things. We believed, you know, long before that. But just for the other portion of my little segment here, I'd like to say thanks to Noe. Noe is really humble, and he won't admit he writes most of those books. He does the bulk of the writing. I probably do 40% of it, if that. And Noe does most of it, but he's just too nice to say anything. And then I tend to handle the layouts and stuff like that. But Noe does the hard stuff. So I just wanted to acknowledge that when you enjoy those books, it's mostly Noe. So thank you, Noe, for letting me tag along on them and doing the fun stuff like laying them out. And Noe and I, for everyone listening, should have at least two more books. I think we're going to... We don't think we want to get into the 1940s because they were covered so well, but we do have a book covering the 1920s. I think we're going to call it UFOs in the Roaring 20s or something like that, and then we plan to hopefully do the 1930s and the Depression era. So that's in the works as well.
That is fantastic. That really is, and the collective we in the world cannot wait to see these books. They're going to be wonderful. So, John, thank you so very much for everything that you've done, for everything that you've brought to ScaryCast. And as a personal friend, I mean, you've been a wonderful person, and I don't think we can thank you enough. So we'll just send money, right? We'll just send money, right? That comes from somebody else. Okay. Devin Tate. Man in Hollywood. What do you think about all of this? Because you are absolutely one of the biggest supporters ScaryCast has ever had.
Well, thank you. You know, I think it's, you know, most people have some recollection or some memory of something that they saw or something that they were, you know, told about that somebody they knew saw. And as you know from, you know, previous episodes of ScaryCast, I have a story from my childhood growing up around Russell, Kansas, that happened in the 80s. And I didn't know much about it at the time because I was a kid, but you would hear things, and there's things in the newspaper about a UFO sighting and a woman who had claimed to be abducted. So, John, I've told you that I was able to track down her book. She actually wrote a book about it along with a doctor, a medical doctor from the area too. And it's very hard to find, but I tracked it down, and I've been reading it. And it's very interesting because it's very you know, the Midwest where I grew up in that part of Kansas is very conservative, Christian. You know, there's a church on every corner. And it's interesting because this particular book and the UFO sighting and abductions is intertwined with religion because the woman, the author, who have the encounter with the aliens refers to them as, you know, biblical beings and makes parallels to the Bible and stories that happened in the Bible and that these prophets are actually extraterrestrials. So Peter, the apostle, is actually an extraterrestrial who visited her on Earth and had biblical prophecies to tell her about. So it's very fascinating. I don't know if there are other, you know, other people who have linked aliens and extraterrestrials with biblical figures, but it's definitely very interesting and thought-provoking. And one point that she makes in it is that, you know, at that time, up until that time, the visitors didn't feel that humans were equipped to really deal with the reality of aliens, you know, and extraterrestrials. And so, you know, I don't know if we're nearing that now, but it does seem like people are starting to, you know, have a little bit more of a constructive way of thinking about it and dealing with it to where maybe, you know, maybe extraterrestrials could make contact now or in the near future and actually have willing, you know, humans that are able to receive the information, which I think is, you know, maybe that's the issue.
Well, we can only wait and see, but those are great reflections. They really are. I mean, what more can you say? You know, we got Dan Brown doing what's it called? Help me, Devin. Dan Brown doing help me out. Lost my mind.
I'm trying to. Yeah, I don't know.
The Da Vinci Code.
Oh, right.
He's doing the Da Vinci Code. And that is a very engaging film and an engaging book. It's like, well, you know, is it real or not? I don't know. Well, I'm doing some research on my own. I'm trying to get involved so that I can find out. I'm going to find out if that's real or not. Dr. John, before I succumb to whatever, I'm going to make sure I know if that is real or not, because I think it's a totally engaging story. And I guess in my closing remarks, I want to thank, here's this guy named John LeMay that I think is one of the coolest people I've ever met. And I'm going to read from American Sightings 1900 to 1919, from the very early pages. It says John LeMay, this has to do with, well, you know, just wanted to thank people. And he said, for my good friend, Dr. John Stamey, keep on believing. And that is the most amazing thing that has ever happened to me, that I got thanked from someone as incredible as John LeMay is, and I don't know what else to say. So, John LeMay, thank you. And thank you for bringing
You're very welcome, John.
And thank you for bringing Noe Torres here. He has been, Noe, you have been a light unto our path as we realize that UFOs are real. And I'm sorry I got reactionary about the legend of Aurora. There's no legend. That was a news story. Right, Noe?
No, but I agree about the legend of John May, because he is a legendary, wonderful person, and he's totally 50-50 in helping me with the books. It's a team effort, and while I may end up coming a little ahead on writing the content, it's a total team effort, and we just are a great team. I've really enjoyed working with him.
Yeah, me too. Well, thank you, Noe. And shout out to our cover artist. Yeah.
The great thing is
I just wanted to mention our cover artist,
you.
Jolene Yates, too.
And we're just so glad. We're so glad to have you on here. And Devin Tate, our man in Hollywood. And Noe, just so that you know, Graham Greene, who won a Pulitzer Prize for his great work, wrote a book called Our Man in Havana. And they made an incredible movie about it in the mid-40s. And Devin has always been our man in West Hollywood. He tells us what's going on out there. And that's why we love Devin, because he keeps us apprised of what's going on. So anyway, I want to say thank you to everybody for one of the most illuminating and one of the most enjoyable episodes of ScaryCast we've ever had. And as I said, we've had Daniel Allen Jones a couple of times. I want to get him back on here along with you, Noe, because I think it would be a lot of fun. So I want to say thank you to everybody. Tonight has been illuminating and wonderful, and I'm going to send out links to this show to a lot of people that need to hear it. So I wanted to thank everybody, and Merry Christmas. Happy everything, and this has been wonderful. So thanks a lot, and we'll see you next week. Same bat time, same bat channel, on the one and only ScaryCast, sponsored by Transamerica. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Good night, everybody. Bye-bye.
Good night.